The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Fandom Files. We're a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zacharin, the features editor here at Sci-Fi Wire, and I'm joined by a very cool guest today, Dean Devlin, the mind behind so many iconic and beloved movies and TV shows at Stargate, Independence Day, Librarian, so many great things. And he's here. He's sitting right across from me right now. He's here at 30 Rock in the radio room. We're going to talk about his career. We're going to put a focus on two projects in particular, along with many other things he's done, one new and one old. He's the director of the upcoming thriller Bad Samaritan, starring David Tennant, who you know as the Doctor, amongst many other things. And he's a writer-producer on the 98 reboot of Godzilla, which is a movie that I rewatched a few nights ago and like really enjoyed. And we talked about that very briefly before we went on the air, and we will continue to do that. But I'll just start now because you're not listening for me. Dean, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
No, absolutely. It's much appreciated you being here. So this movie, you know, Bad Samaritan, why don't you real quickly tell our listener about what our listeners, hopefully it's multiple listeners, tell my girlfriend
Listen,
what
Fred.
This movie is about. One person listening. What is this? What is Bad Samaritan about?
Well, it two young guys who work as valet parkers at a restaurant. And when someone has a very nice car and they come in for dinner, they'll check the GPS in the car to see how far they live. And if they live pretty close to the restaurant, they'll go and rob the house while you're having dinner. You know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, when you hand over your car keys, you're probably also handing over your house keys.
Yeah.
And most, you know, cars can get into the garage on their own, and almost no one locks the door from the garage to the house. So it's a pretty good scam they've got going.
It reminded me a little bit when I watched it of just that moment of Ferris Bueller when they steal the car.
Right. But one day they choose the wrong house. And they find a woman who is being held captive by a serial killer. And our hero suddenly gets a call from his friend saying, the guy wants his car back. Where the hell are you? And he has a choice. Does he stay there and try to rescue this girl? Or does he leave and save his own ass? And he makes the worst choice possible. He leaves the girl, which is why he's the Bad Samaritan.
Right.
But he's so filled with shame and guilt over this terrible decision that he spends the rest of the film trying to redeem himself.
Yeah, and I've seen Jessica Jones, so I can know how scary David Tennant can be, but he's next level here, because he is the serial killer in this movie.
Well, you know, Jessica Jones, he's brilliant in that, and I think it's a brilliant show, but it does rely on a supernatural power.
Mm-hmm.
What makes David so terrifying in this is that he's created a completely 100% grounded psychopath. This guy could live down the hall from you. I mean, this guy could live across the street and probably does.
Yeah, and we're in New York, so probably.
And, you know, he did an enormous amount of research on people who have no ability to have guilt, to feel guilt, or to have empathy for other people. And he constructed a truly, truly terrifying villain.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, at least in Jessica Jones, you know he's got a difficult background, you know, backstory. Here, like, he's just, and it's funny because I, you know, as Doctor Who, you love the guy. And I know you're a big Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
But there is like no redeeming thing here.
Yeah. No, this guy is I described him kind of like an evil Bruce Wayne. You know, he's an incredibly rich person who has no empathy, no sympathy, and is a complete and total psychopath.
He's a very nice guy. I've never met him in person, but I assume he's a very nice guy. When you see him make that shift on set into someone like that, as a director, as a filmmaker, and as someone who I know loves Doctor Who and was a fan before you worked with him, what was it like watching that?
It's crazy because, you know, different actors work different ways. Mm-hmm. Some have to stay in character all the time. And David's a guy who literally can just hit the switch on and off. So before the take, he's literally the sweetest man you've ever met. I mean, he's helping people carry their props onto the set, and he's pouring coffee for you, and he's chit-chatting, being very sweet. And the minute I would say action, you could literally see the muscles in his face moving and his eyes clouding over and getting dark. And suddenly it was really uncomfortable to be on set. Yeah. And I'd see crew members like starting to shift around and feeling, I mean, just somehow your primal brain just knows I'm around something really dangerous and scary. And then I would say cut, and he would smile and say, was that all right? I mean, it was amazing. I mean, he's super talented, but he's also an incredibly generous and sweet man.
Yeah, I feel like when someone's that nice and, you know, you've seen him on TV for all those years, there's like a trust that's built in. And then you see someone who can just so quickly, you know, be a monster. You almost like, even though you know he's acting, there's something scary about that.
Well, that's one of the things that I think really speaks to how talented he is. You know, normally if we fall in love with an actor doing a certain kind of part, that's what we want to see them do. Now, we may tolerate or even appreciate them doing something else, but what we really want is them to do the thing that we like.
Sure.
David played this mad genius on Doctor Who and huge fan base that fell in love with him. But then he did Jessica Jones and played this horrible character, and people had enormous love for his portrayal of that. And then he plays this really deep and damaged detective on Broadchurch,
right.
And people love him for that as well. Movies became more and more and more expensive, and to market them became more and more expensive. And so suddenly the risk was so high, they didn't want to make a mistake. So say they became more formulaic, and they became more voices got involved of what you can and can't do in a feature film. And conversely, television went from 4 channels to 500 channels. And if you're channel 439, the only way you were going to get some attention is you had to do something really interesting.
Right.
And so they started taking more chances. So suddenly the really more interesting, compelling work started to happen on television, and the more formulaic stuff was happening in movies. So, you know, for me, that's the biggest reason to be independent, is to try and bring back the spirit of movies.
We will, I'll just say to the listener, we had a little bit of technical difficulty while Dean was giving a very good explanation about how movies have changed over the years, in the sense that, like you said, like 70s New Hollywood, it was all experimental. And then the 80s and 90s, it started getting more and more expensive and whatnot. And then it became, at this point, really hard to make a movie.
Yeah, so now you see really interesting and fascinating work happening on television, and more and more predictable kind of formulaic work happening in movie theaters. So, you know, I really think that we're about to enter an era where the independent studios are going to start to do, they're going to start to do the movies that the studios have left behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, you know, when you go to a restaurant, you don't want to just see one item on the menu.
Right.
And more, that's what's happening with the studios. You can get a $200 million superhero movie, but not much else.
Right.
So I think we're going to see now places like STX or A24 or Entertainment Studios, or hopefully my company, Electric Entertainment, really kind of filling the holes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder what you think about. So I have MoviePass, right? And that's like a godsend in the sense that I can go, as someone who loves movies, I can go like, if I wanted to, every day. I wish I could, but, you know, like at least a couple of times a week. Right. What do you make of it as a filmmaker who, I guess they pay in full for the ticket. So do you think like that's a big help in the way that Netflix is a help for TV?
I think it's a huge help. I think that what it could do is it could bring back the desire to go to movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was growing up, you went to the movies. A group of you would go to the movie theater and look and see what's playing and say, oh yeah, let's go see that one.
Right.
Nobody does that now.
Right.
People go to a movie. They know what movie they want to go see, and they go see it. And that's a very different thing. MoviePass has brought binge watching to theaters.
Yeah.
And if it could get people back into the habit of going to movies and understanding why it's a unique and special experience, then I think it's going to be really worth it. Now, you know, they obviously have some financial hurdles that they're going to have to solve. You know, I think their plan of being a marketing tool and earning their money through marketing as opposed to the passes themselves, I think is quite smart.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to have to balance the privacy issues of their users versus their ability to offer unique marketing to the studios.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's for me, like I had a few hours to kill a few weeks ago between work and like a friend's birthday party. And I was like, I work around Times Square, so there's nowhere like fun to go. So I was like, oh, what's playing the movies? And I saw Game Night, which is one I had intended on seeing.
Right.
But then, you know, it's really expensive to go to the movies in the city.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if I can pay, you know, one price for a month of movies, then I saw Game Night.
I think it's really a great thing. I'm a big supporter. And, you know, there's also been some anecdotal evidence that actually the theaters do better because when people don't have to pay for their ticket, they're more inclined to spend money at concessions and buy more popcorn and buy other things. So I think it can be really great for everybody. I hope they succeed.
I bought the AMC Stubbs card because I felt really bad for, honestly, I was at a daytime screening and they had at a movie theater and they had someone trying to sell them and like no one was going to do it. No critic or journalist was going to like buy it from this poor kid. So I bought it, but it means you get like, you go front of the line for food and candy and you get like free upgrades. So I went to a movie last weekend with my girlfriend and between MoviePass and like the stub card, I've like never felt like such a good VIP.
Right.
Like it was like, wow, this is a good experience.
Well, you know, that's what movies should make you feel like. You know, they should feel like you're doing something special.
Yeah. And this is obviously being in movies was, I assume, was like your lifetime goal and your dream. And I asked a lot of filmmakers a couple certain questions about their career, how they got to this point. And I'm wondering, what was the first script you ever wrote?
The first script I ever wrote was called The Pom Pom Boys. And it was about two boys who joined cheerleading camp to meet girls.
When did you write this?
It was right after high school. It never got made. That was the first thing I ever wrote. The first thing I ever wrote that was actually produced was Universal Soldier.
Oh, wow. That was real one for one.
Well, that was a crazy experience. Roland Emmerich and I were supposed to do a different movie called Isobar. And long story, the plug got pulled and wasn't going to get made. And so the head of the studio called in Roland into his office and said, well, I'm sorry that didn't happen, but I've got another movie. It's called Universal Soldier. It stars Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren. And if you don't spend more than $12 million, you can make it. The movie's greenlit. And we start shooting in 6 weeks.
Wow.
And Roland said, what's it about? And he said, I don't care. As long as it's called Universal Soldier, it stars these two guys. You don't spend more than $12 million and we start shooting in 6 weeks. So Roland called me up and he's like, this is fantastic. We have a greenlit movie, you know, and these are the stars in it. And I said, Roland, do you know who Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren is? He goes, no, but they must be very important because they signed this deal. So I went to Blockbuster and I got all these videotapes of their movies. And I came to Roland's house and I started playing them. And he was getting more and more depressed watching each video. And I finally said, okay, so what's the opening scene of a movie starring these two guys? And Roland went, well, they kill each other. And that's the opening of a film. They kill each other and they turned into zombies.
That's really funny. I mean, and you know, they just reunited to do a film, like an indie film together. That's going to come out in a couple months.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
I would definitely be the first in line for that.
That must have been a wild experience, like all of a sudden writing a movie for those. Like the first first made screenplay with those two actors in particular.
It was crazy. It was fun. It was nutty. We were in the Arizona desert the whole time. I mean, it was a blast.
And so when you're writing dialogue for those two guys, was there anything to keep in mind?
Well, you know, my favorite joke in the movie never got a laugh, but at one point, he's with this girl and the girl asks him, you know, about where he's from. And he gives a kind of a bland answer. She goes, oh, I was wondering because of your accent. And Jean-Claude Van Damme looks and goes, what accent?
And no one knows.
Never got a laugh for me. I thought it was hilarious.
That's really good. That's wild first experience.
It was wild.
Yeah. And so you've done so many things, so this is probably you could probably name 4,000 of these things, but when you're either as a writer or a director, what has been the hardest thing to crack, like individual scene?
Every movie has its own challenges, and everything has its own things that you have to deal with, but probably the hardest was actually on Bad Samaritan, because, again, we originally only supposed to shoot for 31 days. Mm-hmm. And then we got hit with five snowstorms.
Oof, and five snowstorms?
And five snowstorms in Portland is like saying five snowstorms in Phoenix, Arizona. I mean, just like it doesn't happen. And we got hit with them. And there's a whole section of the movie that takes place up in these hills. Mm-hmm. And we originally only had 5 days scheduled to shoot it, which everyone said, you'll never get it done in 5 days. There's too much work to do in 5 days. But I had no choice because on day six, I was going to lose David Tennant. So I had to shoot it in 5 days.
Sure.
So we got up to the mountains. We shot for 2 days. It came out great. We thought, all right, we're going to make this. And the night, a giant snowstorm hit.
Yeesh.
So the next day we show up, everything's blanketed in snow. So not only now did I have to shoot the rest in snow, I had to go reshoot the first 2 days up there because they weren't in snow and it wasn't going to match. So that was probably the most challenging thing I've ever had to do is to shoot that much material, that difficult material in the snow and with so little time to do it.
How did you get it all done?
again, I have the greatest crew in the world. We've been working together 10 years up in Oregon, and they're just amazing people. And so, you know, my stunt team came in, and they started doing some of the stunt stuff on a second unit. And then I had a third unit that was doing inserts while I was doing main unit with the acting. And and it really just, we wouldn't have been able to do it had we not had 10 years of work together where we all trusted each other and had a shortcut language. And they knew how I would shoot it if I was going to shoot it. Right. So they could shoot that for me, you know. And so it worked out really well.
Yeah, it's so crucial to have that trust in that crew, especially on such a small movie.
Well, you know, directors, you know, we get a lot of credit, but the truth is, you know, we're driving a bus filled with talented people.
Yeah.
And if that bus is empty, very few directors are going to look good.
Right. Yeah. You know?
And these people, they make me look good.
Who would you say is your artistic hero?
My artistic hero?
Yeah.
Well, as a filmmaker, it's definitely Spielberg. Mm-hmm. I mean, those were the movies that just moved me the most growing up, but you know, Lucas and James Cameron. You know, these were the people I grew up with just wanting to be and who I idolized.
Mm-hmm. What is the best creative advice you've ever been given?
Well, in my case, it was, I was struggling on a scene I was writing, and Roland Emmerich was getting frustrated because I was taking forever to write it. And he came in and he goes, "What's the problem? Why, where's the scene?" And I said, "I don't know. I keep reading this dialogue and I feel like I've heard it in other movies before. And it just feels just doesn't feel great." And Roland put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Look, kid, you're not a genius." And he goes, "But it's okay. I'm not one either. But if we work really, really hard, one day we'll be craftsmen. And there's room in this world for good craftsmen."
Hmm.
And that really kind of took all the pressure off. I know I'm never going to be Martin Scorsese, but if I work really hard, I could make really well-crafted films that are enjoyable and have a place in our history of films.
Sure.
And I really feel like that's been my path.
You know, what's funny is you made Independence Day so early on. Did you feel like you had to live up to that for all those, for so long?
To some degree, you know, I mean, because it's so long ago, people don't realize that at the time it was literally the most successful movie the history of movies. So there was enormous pressure. And, you know, I know you want to talk about Godzilla, but that was probably the biggest problem in making Godzilla, was this assumption that it was going to be as big or as original or as strong as Independence Day.
Right.
And I don't think it ever had that chance.
I mean, few things do. Right.
Yeah. So I think in one regard, it was judged overly harshly. And in another regard, you know, we didn't live up to what we needed to do mm-hmm. in taking on something as iconic as Godzilla. So, you know, I think that some of it was our failings and some of it was a perception problem. But well, I think, as you said, when people see the movie now where they have very low expectations, they tend to go, "Wow, that movie's actually pretty good."
No, I really enjoyed it. And the thing I realized is, like, as a big Godzilla fan, it had a lot of the initial beats. Like, in the beginning of the movie, there's a lot of things that I recognize, you know, the military guy and the scientist and the journalist kind of, you know, at odds and, you know, talking a lot. And then the movie kind of becomes sort of Jurassic Park-y mm-hmm. and sort of Alien-y. And I'm wondering, that's a tough thing to do, trying to Americanize such a iconic Japanese movie. That's inherently difficult.
Well, I think aside from the mistakes I made in the script, which there's quite a few, I think part of the biggest problem was that I pushed Roland into doing the movie because I was a huge Godzilla fan. I grew up with Godzilla, and it wasn't something that Roland had grown up with. He didn't have a giant passion about Godzilla. Now, he was able to find a story with me that he could get passionate about. And he was passionate about the movie we made,
mm-hmm.
but this was his take on it, as opposed to honoring the Godzilla legacy in a way that would make the people who love Godzilla happy. You know?
Sure.
I remember not long after that, I was having a conversation with Bryan Singer about X-Men, and he was telling me how he was reading every comic book, and he was really, and I just said, yes, don't try to make a better version,
right?
Make the best version of what it is.
Because I feel like the first half of Godzilla 98 really does kind of honor that. You know, like I said, it has all those beats. I'm not a purist. I enjoyed the movie for what it is. Then you have all the baby Godzillas, mm-hmm. right? And was that, do you feel like where it diverged and Roland really wanted to do, but people had trouble with?
No, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of problems with it, but I think the biggest problem that we had was Roland and I together made an intellectual idea that is an interesting idea, but not compelling filmmaking. And what it was is we said, in real life, a lizard is neither evil nor good. It's just a lizard.
Mm-hmm.
So what if a lizard got to that size and in its effort to survive, it threatened us? But
right.
It wasn't mad at us. It wasn't evil. And it wasn't benevolent and good either. It was just simply doing what it did, and it caused this problem for us. Well, that's interesting, but that's not Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
Godzilla is either somebody you're, you know, if you go to the very, very first one, Gojira, it was a monster.
Yeah.
It was evil. But all the movies after, it was a hero.
Right. Yeah.
And we didn't choose either. And I think that was an enormous mistake. I think if you're going to do a Godzilla movie, you should take the position that it's either a monster or a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And then you should develop that character accordingly. I think what we tried to do made sense, but I don't think it's very fulfilling. You know, there's this big sequence at the end of Godzilla where you hear his heartbeat and he's dying and it's supposed to be emotional. And it's not, because we're not sure how we're supposed to feel about Godzilla. Mm. Were we supposed to be rooting Godzilla? Were we supposed to be scared of Godzilla? The film did not make a commitment to how you should feel about the character. And I think that was, at its heart, the bigger mistake than the baby Godzillas or anything else.
Sure. Although it's funny, as you mentioned the first movie, we feel bad for Godzilla in the 1954 version too. So there's an element of like, he doesn't know what the hell is going on also. So I did feel that, you know, I give yourself a little more credit, because I did feel that idea that the first one is, you know, just this gigantic who gets awakened by, you know, nuclear experiments. And right. He doesn't know what's going on. So when the oxygen destroyer happens, you know, you feel bad for Godzilla
sure.
there too.
Yeah, and you know, again, we were trying to emulate that first Godzilla version, but even the version before Raymond Burr was cut into it.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that we realized later is that almost no one in the world had ever seen that
version.
That's
true. Yeah, later.
Yeah, so we were doing a lot of references to a version of the film that nobody had seen.
That's very true. That's very true. And like in the movie where she says, you know, it's Gojira, not Godzilla. Like yeah, that.
Most people had no idea what that was.
That's funny. And in hindsight, I've seen the 1954 version a million times, but you're right. At the time, people weren't streaming it, you know, on Filmstruck or something.
And it is a heartbreak for me. As I said, I'm going to all these sci-fi conventions promoting the movie, and I always see these stands with Godzilla, and they always leave out our Godzilla. And it's so heartbreaking. It's like, really? This is a place to celebrate the cheesiness of Godzilla, and we're not even good enough to be cheesy?
He was in the Final Wars, right? They had a bit appearance of the 98 Godzilla
oh,
in Final
they?
Wars. Yeah,
that.
Yeah. He's one of the many monsters who gets killed.
Oh.
But all the other monsters get killed too. Don't worry. He wasn't alone in that. And I wanted to ask, we're in New York. If I'm a Knicks fan, it's like really self-harm at this point, but I'm a Knicks fan. I'm a Rangers fan. You destroy Madison Square Garden in this in this movie. And honestly, like I said before, like it should have stayed that way. But I'm wondering, what was it? Did you shoot in the garden? How did you get permission to involve that brand?
No, we shot on the exterior of the garden, mm-hmm. and we actually built the garden on sound
wow.
stages in Hollywood. They were some of the biggest, craziest sets you've ever seen.
That's crazy.
But we did get to do the premiere of the movie in the garden, and that was just the craziest and best screening of the movie.
Yeah.
To be inside the garden as it blows up was pretty fun.
That's so cool. And the Dolan still, they owned it back then, right?
You know, I don't know.
Okay, so was it difficult to get them to be involved?
No. Sony reached out, and they were very excited to do it, and it was a huge premiere. I don't think there'd ever been anything like that before. But, you know, it's such a large venue
yeah.
that what we discovered is that if you sat near the back, the movie was actually out of sync, because by the time the sound would travel from the screen to you in the back, it no longer matched the visual, because the speed of light was faster than the speed of sound.
Did they play it on the big screen? How did that, is that what?
They erected a huge screen, and it was crazy. It was
that's
a crazy
wild.
Fun night.
That's really cool. I remember seeing Springsteen at the Garden, and that was way far back, and seeing him up on the big screen, it did not sync with
right.
the music.
Yeah.
So,
now you know why.
Yeah, that's really cool. And so when you look back on the movie, are there parts of it that you really like that you think don't get enough appreciation?
I think Roland did a great job with it. I think the mistakes in the movie are in the script, and those are my fault. You know, there were things that we wanted to try. You know, we thought, you know, all movies are set up conflict resolution. What if we do a movie where we just throw you into the movie
mm-hmm.
and then we wait for the lull of the second act to expose who the characters are?
Sure.
Again, an interesting idea, but it doesn't work that way, because if you wait that long, the audience has already made up their mind of what they feel about the characters.
Mm.
The reason you do a setup is to help shape the emotions around a character. So for instance, the reporter, she just seemed like a dingbat in the first act, and so everyone hated her. So even when we gave you the real backstory of who she was in the second act, it was too late by then. You've already judged her, and you couldn't get behind her. And even the Matthew Broderick character, which I think he did a great job in his acting, but we didn't know enough about him to really root for him until we learned about him later. So that was a huge lesson. And I'm glad we did the experiment, but I'll never do that again. I start movies by explaining who the characters are.
You know, although, you know, with the reporter character, she was being harassed by Harry Shearer. So, you know, I feel like there was some weirdly timely, actually. Yeah. Well, listen, you got a screening tonight in Alamo Draft House in New York, in Brooklyn. That's really exciting.
Yeah, we're really excited. We're doing this with Dread Central, and it's a big fan screening, and Robbie Sheehan is going to be there tonight, one of the stars of the picture, and we're going to do a Q&A afterwards. So,
awesome.
Yeah, we're really excited.
We'll hope you enjoy that. Go see, what day is it at? What day is this movie out?
May the 4th be with you.
There you go. After you watch Star Wars, go see Bad Samaritan.
Please, a theater near you.
Thanks so much, Dean.
Thank you.